This podcast was made possible thanks to the generous support of Mr. David Salerno.
Welcome to the very first segment of the first episode of Liberty and Wine. I'm Michel, and I'm joined here today with my friend Peter, and we're going to talk about rich folks and ultra-rich folks and whether or not it would make sense to, you know, make them pay and maybe contribute, quote-unquote, a little bit more to the needs that, you know, our government and some would say our society have, because, you know, there are, due to, you know, financial markets and investment, a disparity in the level of wealth that some say is unparalleled. Some uber rich people, you know, like Jeff Bezos, I mean, are worth, the last time I checked anyway, it was $173 billion. I mean, when you have an amount like that, which is almost like an abstraction, I mean, you ask yourself, how many mansions can a guy have? How many triple A beefsteaks can he eat? I mean, isn't it kind of a little bit excessive to have people that are so wealthy when there are other ones that are clearly not well off at all? So I think, you know, we got to sort of think a little bit about that. And think about, you know, whether or not now you're getting floating, you know, the idea of a wealth tax as a way to, you know, and we're going to talk and explain what is a wealth tax, how does it work, and would it be a good way to have one? There are suggestions from political parties, both in Canada, in the U.S., and even in other countries. And there are countries also that have experimented with, you know, such a tax weapon, shall we say. So all of that, pretty cool. You know, even though it's only 11:45 a.m., in order to be true to the concept of the show, Peter and I are sipping away a nice glass of white wine, about which I'll tell you, a Greek white wine, about which I'll tell you more about it later on the show. So, Peter, welcome.
Well, thank you, Michel. It's great to be here.
How do you feel of having the honor, or maybe the dishonor? We'll see that when time passes. But how do you feel about being the very first guest of Liberty and Wine?
That's right, the first guinea pig. It is exciting to drink before noon, I will say. I'm not used to that. Maybe we can make this a new thing here.
Yeah, you bet. Well, you know, it's there's something to be said for that. It just depends on how long the day will be, but that's another issue. You know, I was mentioning in my intro, you know, about like people like Bezos or Buffett or Gates. And some of these folks, by the way, even themselves say that, you know, they should be more taxed. So why don't we sort of try to think in terms of, I mean, what does it mean when you're worth billions and billions of dollars? And what does it mean in practice? What's the consequence, positive or negative, that it has on society?
Right. So probably the single most important fact about wealth, when we're talking about billionaires, right, when we're talking about extreme wealth, the single most important fact is that the vast majority of it, around 95%, is invested, right? So a big chunk of it, depending on how the person made it, in Jeff Bezos' case, almost all of his wealth is invested in Amazon.com, the company he built. And then, you know, between fixed incomes, bonds, which is, you know, money that's either lent to the government or lent to other companies, pensions, which again, pensions are invested. Maybe they're invested again in corporate equities and government bonds. When you put that together, 95% of what these rich people have is invested in the economy. And what that means is that it's being used to create businesses, to create jobs.
So sort of working capital, we could say.
That's exactly right. About 5% of it is physical assets, which is overwhelmingly the house. So, you know, when we're talking about taxing rich people, it's easy to sort of demonize them as these, you know, monopoly man, you know, living astride the world, having champagne. But when you're actually talking about the money, 95 cents on the dollar is building businesses. It is lent back. It is contributed back into society to make society wealthier.
And then, so I guess, you know, if you look at it from that angle, then the question might be, who do you trust the most to create wealth and to develop things with those financial assets, Jeff Bezos or politicians or bureaucrats? Because I guess it comes down to that, because the people who are of the view that a big chunk of their money should be taken away, essentially what they mean is that they don't want the initial creator of the wealth to use it, but rather to have, you know, governments, which means politicians and bureaucrats, to, you know, make judgment calls about the best usage of that money.
Right. So if we want to improve things, we should actually do the opposite of a wealth tax. We should remove all taxes on investing. Maybe you can keep taxes on income if you like, you know, if you want to even things up. But in terms of social efficiency, that's exactly the question. Who is most qualified to make the decisions? What resources can make society better off, can create jobs, can create wealth? And that's probably somebody like Jeff Bezos. And so if you want more of that in the world, you should remove the taxes on capital.
Then why are these folks sort of saying that they would like to be taxed more?
I mean, you've always had that throughout history that, you know, once people climb the ladder, they pull the ladder back up after them. I mean, this is, you know, this is human behavior. It's not a pretty side of human nature, but it's always existed. You know, from his perspective, if he gives another $1 million in tax revenue and then all of the other rich people in the world also give $1 million, then he can effectively sort of leverage his influence on the world. You know, so it's, you know, there are many things in this world that I might not give a dollar, but if I could give a dollar and force everybody else in the whole world to give a dollar too, right? Well, that gives me an enormous amount of power. So not to guess what his goals are here, but right. I mean, it is a pattern throughout history that once people make it, some of them do pull the ladder up after them and make it harder on the next people.
But could it be as simple as just virtue signaling? Because we do have in our societies a lot of that. I mean, you know, when you see people on their, you know, Facebook profile wearing a mask, you know, and I'm not making a comment here about the value of wearing masks. That's not my point. But, you know, clearly, if they're in their home taking a private picture, they're not protecting anybody by showing that they're wearing a mask. So I think, in essence, what they want to send as a signal is, you know, I am a virtuous person. And so I've always been of the view that a lot of what, you know, a certain number of these folks say, consciously or not, is something along the line of virtue signaling.
I think for sure. And, you know, for a certain part of society, it appears virtuous to take resources from people who've earned it and hand it over to the government. Now, you could argue that virtue consists of giving opportunity to everybody in society, even people who are not rich. That tends to be what people on our side believe. And if that were the case, if you want to spread opportunity as widely as possible, then you would do the exact opposite. As much as possible, you would push resources back into the wealth creators and the job creators rather than, you know, consigning it to the doom of government custodianship.
But if we did want, and there were in the past wealth taxes, if we get specifically to the topic of wealth tax, you know, how would that work? What is a wealth tax? How is it calculated? How is it charged? Like, not, I don't want, like, especially at 11 in the morning, you know, I want like a tax course, but just like a general explanation of how these taxes work.
Right. So broadly speaking, they do vary by country. And the general concept is we're going to measure the value of everything you own. And then we're going to tax, let's say, 1% of that. And so if you have $100 million in net worth, then we're going to come for $1 million of that every year. And the trick, of course, is you've got a couple problems, right? One is, how do you measure it? You know, so especially many businesses in Canada, they're not publicly traded. Okay, so you might, I don't know, you might fix cars and you own a garage, and that garage is not traded on the stock exchange. So how do we estimate what's that? What is that worth? And so that can get tricky, right? So governments have to start making all kinds of assumptions and estimates and guesses. That makes it hard if you own the garage, because you don't know what government's going to decide your business is worth, right? And then the other problem, of course, you have is that once you start playing that game, okay, good. So what do you do with art? Okay, what do you do with a university degree? Is that an asset? Okay, if it's not an asset, then, you know, people can start shifting their resources. You know, if your giant yacht is not considered wealth the way that your business is, then you have an incentive to take your money out of the business and put it into the yacht. And so as a society, do we want rich people to spend more money on yachts, or do we want them to spend more money creating jobs?
But please elaborate a bit regarding your yacht example. I'm not sure I fully grasp what you mean.
So specific to yachts, there have been a number of cases where, you know, because a yacht is kind of a house and kind of a vehicle, there have been cases where they've been used for jurisdictional arbitrage. In other words, to essentially pretend that you live somewhere else. In addition, yachts sort of illustrate a wider point, which is that each wealth tax, because it is so complicated, right? You have to decide what's taxable, what's not taxable, which personal goods are included. Is your car included? What about if the car is an antique? What about if the car is an extremely valuable antique? And these sort of relate back to a broader issue, which is really sort of critical to the wealth tax, which is that they encourage this sort of kind of playing around, okay? What they also do is that because if you buy a consumer good, let's say that you buy a really nice car. Now, cars depreciate, right? They lose value over time. That means that any sort of rational wealth tax, right? If it's based on any sort of accounting rationale, the amount of tax you pay is actually going to go down on that. Meanwhile, if you put your money in a business and it presumably grows, you're going to be paying more tax over time. So there's really this whole cluster of perverse incentives that encourage you to use the money instead of investing it. And then they encourage you to do all kinds of weird things with it, playing with taxes.
It's certainly one of the problems. But the other thing also that I've been told, and actually I've seen some evidence on that, but you might want to, you know, explain a bit further, is that several countries, and I would even dare to say most countries, who have had wealth taxes, then actually pulled it off, you know, canceled it after a certain number of years. Why that is, and could you give us a few examples of countries that had a wealth tax and then canceled it afterwards?
For sure. There have been mostly, you know, there was sort of a fad for wealth taxes in Europe. And ultimately, 12 countries had them in 1990. That's now down to 3 countries. Okay, so almost all of them have been canceled in, you know, we're talking 3 decades. And the problems, so one of them was it's very expensive to administer it, right? You have to sit there and have your bureaucrats guessing what everything's worth. The other problem is that they raise very, very little money. And the reason is because of those distortions, right? So if you can shift your money into, you know, government bonds or into art or whatever it is, if you can do that to avoid the tax, a lot of people will. All right. So not only do you have to keep chasing those people constantly, but in addition, you're not going to end up raising very much money. So the average in Europe was about 0.2% of GDP, which is it's almost nothing. But in return, as those people, right, they might sell their company and put it into art, something like that. You get these distortions, these economic distortions, where money is moving from a good use, a productive use, but an easy to see use. It's moving into some resource that's hard for the tax man to see, or that has some other privilege, like it's a government bond. So resources are distorted and you get this tremendous hit to economic growth, right? While you're raising very, very little money at great expense.
Wasn't there also the fact that, you know, certain people ended up being hit by the wealth tax, even though they weren't particularly wealthy, and in some cases couldn't pay the tax? You know, I was told, for instance, of the case of farmers on an island in southern France who, you know, were wealthy in the sense that the land that they owned was worth a lot of money, but, you know, and so they hit the threshold by which they were taxed by the wealth tax of France, but they weren't people who had a lot of cash. So they ended up having to sell their land just in order to be able to pay that wealth tax. And that's certainly not what the French government had in mind or their intention initially when they had that tax. So don't we have those kinds of cases too, of sort of unintended consequences, one could say?
For sure. And that's a 500-year pattern of governments that when they bring in a new tax, right, if you take the income tax in Canada, for example, when they first bring in the tax, it's extremely light and it only hits the rich, okay, because the rich are easy to demonize. And once it's in there, once it gets comfortable, once it's moved in, it progressively goes down and down and down to the point where today in Canada, it's not the rich who are paying income tax. It's everybody who's hit with that tax. So whatever they're going to do to the rich today, they're going to do to you tomorrow.
Yeah. Scary. But, you know, we do have historical deficits or very important deficits due to the reaction of governments to the COVID crisis. And the purpose here is not to debate whether the governments were right in what they did, but they did spend a lot of money and they are spending a lot of money. And so, you know, what, you know, governments need more money. And so, you know, if not the wealth tax, then what then, you know?
Right. And something that we have consistently emphasized is opportunity, that it is extremely important to grow wealth, to grow productivity, to spread opportunity. And what that means is the exact opposite of this kind of tax. It means deregulation, lower taxes on businesses, lower burdens on businesses, which might be an upcoming problem post-COVID. And in addition to that, in terms of deficits, yes, there's reopening the economy. And of course, we want to do that carefully and we want to protect everybody. But there's also a question of this tremendous government spending at all levels across the country. If we're looking for a quick fix on the deficit, it would be nice to see the same creativity and energy put towards eliminating wasteful government spending, eliminating bureaucrats, entire departments that are not actually spreading opportunity to people, rather are simply consuming resources.
And just to be clear, you mean eliminating the position of the bureaucrats, not the bureaucrats physically themselves?
Yes, we have to be very clear these days. So, right.
Okay.
Right. I dream of a future where bureaucrats can find a job, maybe as a, you know, as a waiter or a construction worker or something useful.
All right. Anything else that, you know, people should have in mind when they're thinking of how the wealth tax will end up hurting Main Street?
One important detail, which is it's kind of a vulnerability of a wealth tax, is that if somebody proposes to tax the rich 1% or 2%, it sounds quite low. It sounds quite easy, right? You know, you've got a lot. I'm just going to take 2% per year. But the thing to keep in mind is that because that tax comes in each and every year, right? So for example, today bonds, government bonds are paying under 3%. So a 2% tax is not going to be a little tiny hit. It's going to take most of what that money would have earned every single year. So wealth taxes, they look small, but they can cause a tremendous amount of distortion because of how low interest rates are at the moment.
All right. Well, listen, Peter, I've enjoyed that conversation. I've enjoyed it so much that we're going to actually ask you to hang tight and stay, and we'll have you for the second portion of Liberty and Wine.
Excellent. Thank you, Michelle.
So for this second portion of the first episode of Liberty and Wine, we're going to talk about an interesting topic. At first, when Peter proposed it, I thought he had smoked something illegal, but then, you know, he explained it to me and I thought this was actually pretty cool. But so the topic reads as such: Modern Lessons from the Mongol Conquest of China, How Deficit Financing Converts Government from Parasite to Cancer. And so Peter, I understand that you did actually a thesis on that topic. How does someone end up, you know, choosing a topic like that, which, you know, seem a little very peculiar, let's say?
So I was a professor of economics over in Taiwan, and I am interested in economic history. And one of the parallels that I found interesting is that between the barbarian conquests of Rome, the fall of the Roman Empire, and the Mongol conquest of China, and then on to the world. And so I dug into those, sort of what were the reasons. And one of the striking sort of similarities is that you had a period of hyperinflation immediately preceding the conquests.
Both case.
Right. And actually, it occurred two times in the Song Dynasty. So, right, in three cases. And that got me interested in whether this was sort of a pattern, right? Was this economic? Was this not simply a question that barbarians were super fighters, but that there was something internal happening, some sort of internal rot that was making these societies vulnerable to conquest?
You dug into this and looked specifically at the fall of the Song Dynasty.
Right. So the Song Dynasty, so that was about the year 1000 to 1300. And that is considered in China probably the most sort of golden age. Lots of things that we use today were invented in the Song era. It was really one of the golden ages of human history. And in many ways, it was extremely modern, right? So, for example, people at the time complained that women didn't know how to cook anymore because everybody was eating out at restaurants all the time. All right. It was an extremely wealthy time. You had a very, very well-developed civil society. So it's an interesting period to study. And what happened in the Song Dynasty is that a reformer came in named Wang Anqi. And Wang was what we would today call a socialist. So he was, you know, very interested in changing sort of wealth dynamics. And what he did was initially he you know, seized assets from rich people. He gave free credit to everybody, and then he would sort of forgive it over and over. And what he was enabled by was one of the biggest inventions in human history, which was the printing press. And what the printing press allowed for the very first time is that it was very, very cheap to print money, right? So there was paper money in China at the time. These were warehouse receipts for silver or for tea, but the Song government under Wang figured, you know what, we could print up fake ones, call them silver certificates, and then we could require people to accept them on pain of death. So if you refused these functionally counterfeit silver certificates, then it was the death penalty.
Well, you know, our governments are a bit softer today, but I'm seeing some similarity right now.
For sure. Humanity, unfortunately, ran with the paper money concept.
But, okay, so you could say that, you know, it had an impact, but specifically, what happened? Like, walk us through, and listen, we have not so much time, so you're going to cover, you know, probably 30-year history of China, but like, what happened, like, from that moment you're talking about to the fall, like a quick sort of historical rundown of the sequence of events.
For sure. So in the Song Dynasty, when it began, it was relatively free market. Okay, that was probably one of the reasons why it was the golden age. And government revenue was raised by taxing businesses, functionally, either landowners or merchants. And so that was nice because it set up this sort of synergy between government and producers. Okay, so the imperial exams at the time had lots of advice on how to make sure that your farmers and your merchants and your factories in your area were healthy. And it was very important for government bureaucrats to make sure that commerce was going well in their region, okay? Because otherwise people would revolt and the government didn't want that, okay? So there was this nice synergy and government was very interested in making sure that the economy was healthy. Now, once paper money came into it, this changed it because now the government didn't need taxes. It could print the money it needed. And that worked for a little while, okay? But then the problem, of course, is that once you start down that path, now this is about a 30-year process from beginning to end, so it wasn't overnight. But once you start down that process, you do ultimately get hyperinflation, right? So once they printed up a little bit of money, they were tempted to print up a lot more money. And the problem is that you print up all this new money, but at that point, because of inflation, it's not worth much anymore. But you still have to pay some people real money, which in this period would have meant silver. So for example, you have to pay your army. Okay, if you try to pay your army with paper, you're going to have problems. So in order to get that silver that they actually did need, how did they get that? Well, at that point, they took it. They just seized it from businesses. They took it from, again, merchants and landowners were you know, sort of the economic actors of the age. And this, first it discouraged them. If you're a merchant or a landowner and government is coming and taking everything, you might stop doing that, right? You might do something else with your dime. You might just read books.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the second problem, which is, you know, sort of a famous discussion by historians, is how many landowners and merchants failed to put up a fight when the time came, right? So, and you also saw this in Rome. You had many Romans who, you know, fled to the German lines because they were being so oppressively taxed. Their assets were being taken from them. They were on the edge of starvation.
That's scary and but, you know, not surprising in a way when you know the dynamic of these things. But so, I mean, are we heading in that direction today? I mean, are we on the verge of a Mongolian, you know, invasion or what? You know?
Right. So fortunately, we don't have barbarians on our border. Of course, the situation that we're in today is nowhere near this extreme. What it's more interesting in terms of sort of parallels is focusing on that synergy between government and business. Right. So it's very important that government be interested in how businesses are doing. When governments have their own independent source of revenue, right? When governments can either print money or borrow an unlimited amount, when they can essentially make their own money, they become less interested in how well business is doing. And then they might start putting in policies that are quite harmful. And we've been seeing this during COVID, right? There's been a lot of discussion where, you know, you can see that politicians are very interested in jobs, in, you know, letting people continue working. There's still a very healthy synergy between government and the economy. And that's something that we don't want to weaken.
Now, you're right. And I like this insight, you know, of that, you know, the parasite, let's say, if you would want to take sort of a libertarian perspective on government. And I'm not saying that, you know, I do think that governments have genuinely useful functions, but so I'm using the word parasite as a metaphor, but at least the parasite, there's a dynamic where, you know, it doesn't want to kill the host. It needs a host that's alive and well, you know, versus something that becomes a cancer that really kills the beast. Or, you know, I had, you know, someone sometime several years ago told me that the difference between social democrats and communists is that the social democrats want to milk the cow, but they also want to care for the cow. They want to feed the cow because they want the cow to give milk every morning, whereas the communists just want to kill the cow and eat the meat. And so let us hope that, you know, that we will remain in a context where governments – will see businesses and entrepreneurs and workers as being those cows that have to be nurtured. I mean, I would hope that it would be different than that, but I think if we can at least get that versus the cow eaters that just kill the cow, I think, you know, we have a hope of not falling as hard as what occurred in what you're describing of that period of China.
That's exactly right. We need government and business to be on the same side, on the same team. We need governments that are interested in economic growth, interested in jobs, as opposed to governments who just sort of dance to their own tune and do whatever sounds good in the newspaper today.
All right, Peter. Well, listen, I'll keep you for a few extra minutes. We're going to take a brief pause and then go to the third and last section of our podcast, which is the formal wine section, where we're going to be talking about the wine that we were sipping through the first two portions of the podcast. Dear listeners, the first thing I want to say is that I am not a wine expert by any means. I don't know the wine vocabulary for the most part. I'm just a regular guy who likes to drink wine and who's passionate about sharing, you know, his views on the latest wine or the wine that I like, and just talk to my friends and to my surroundings, you know, the people in my surroundings about the fact, you know, of, hey, you know, there's this wine and I've had it and I liked it. So this there's no more pretense than that. But I do think that, you know, that wine is a pleasure of life that makes life more bearable and, quite frankly, just outright more pleasant, whether in a relaxed cocktail context or, you know, in a dinner. So the wine that I want to propose today is the Santo Wines Assyrtiko from Santorini. I'm drinking right now the 2000. We are drinking right now the 2019. But, you know, I think the general point I'm making is that the white wines from the volcanic Greek islands of Santorini are just great. And the island of Santorini, by the way, is great. If you do go there, try to go outside of the beaten path. I had the chance to do that. And, you know, it's really, you know, the tourists tend to really flock like a few areas. But there's a lot of interesting things in that area, in that island, especially towards the center of the island. You know, so anyway, just try to go out of beaten path. But coming back to the wine, so the Assyrtiko grape is arguably Greece's most iconic wine grape variety. It is actually now globally famous. We know that it's planted as far as Australia and California. And I've been, you know, in the beat of that wine for quite some time. It's not a recent discovery for me. Well, this particular one is. I'm trying it today, but I've been drinking the Assyrtiko grape for several years now. And I especially like its food friendliness. And this feature is especially appreciated when, like me, you don't have a big wine cellar at home. So the wines that you have at home, they have to be, I would say, versatile and being able to fit with many different types of food. And which is the case with, you know, with the Assyrtiko grape. And this wine in particular is a good and noble representative of it. The Santo wine Assyrtiko from Santorini. So wine critic Bill Zakharyev, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing, I think it's more like Zakharyev, made a summary of this wine that really captures my own view of it. So he says, quote, "It's one of my favorite Greek white on the market. It is aromatic without being overbearing, loaded with tropical fruits, and yet dry and mineral on the finish." And I think that for me, it's that mineral touch that does it. It has sort of the taste of the sea, that crunchy salt sea or oyster type. And by the way, you know, it makes a fantastic combination with oysters. If you know, like oysters, I would give my entire empire for oysters. I think it's probably my favorite food, one of my favorite food. And when you combine it with a great white wine like this, whether this one or a Sancerre or something like that, you know, it's pretty evenly. So keep that in mind. What was your own view, Peter, you know, of that white that you had the chance to taste? Not like a Chablis, eh?
No, my God, no. No, it's a class above. I feel, you know, maybe it's my imagination because it's a volcanic wine, but I feel like you can taste the sort of mineral aspect to it. I was surprised at the, you know, the sort of citrus tones. I did not know that Greek wine went there.
Yeah, no. I mean, you're right. It's, you know, it's one of those wine that, I mean, for its price point, okay? I mean, I'm not trying to tell my listeners that it's the greatest wine that has ever been made, but for the price point, it's surprisingly, you know, it has it all. It has all the different kinds of features that you would want in a wine, and at price points that are usually, I mean, in a Canadian market, you know, somewhere between $17 to maybe $30-$35 a bottle, you know, so it's accessible for most people, and it's pretty darn good. And by the way, I'm not getting paid for the wines that I recommend, but I wish I were. So on that note, Peter, it's been really great talking to you, and hope to have you on the show in the not too distant future again.
Thank you, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
All right.